Ryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. Thank you for joining us today, our third JPC event this week. I appreciate the loyalty. There are a lot of people signing on that have been with us for the other two, which is the Emmett webinar from Monday and Elon Berman, who was with us on Tuesday. If you missed those, you can download them from our website. Today, our guest is Josh Hammer, Newsweek opinion editor and a sort of intellectual jack of all trades. I'm going to give you first the Jewish Policy Center definition and background, but I'm going to do it in short form, assuming that a lot of you heard it already at least once this week. We were established in 1985 as a 501c3 organization, providing analysis of both foreign and domestic policies. You can find us on our website at jewishpolicycenter.org. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. And that's where you can download Elon Berman's terrific webinar from Tuesday and a lot of other interesting stuff. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. As an organization that sits somewhat to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, and energy security, which is our big thing right now, as well as free speech and intellectual diversity. Now I'm going to introduce our speaker, Josh Hammer, and I'm really pleased to do this because I think he is terrific. I know you will think he is terrific as we go through this. Josh Hammer is opinion editor of Newsweek and a research fellow at the Edmund Burke Foundation, a constitutional attorney by training, University of Chicago Law School. He is also of counsel at First Liberty Institute and a syndicated columnist. Prior to joining Newsweek, Josh was editor-at-large for Daily Wire. He has been a John Marshall Fellow with the Claremont Institute and a law clerk for Senator Mike Lee of Utah. He's been published just about everywhere, from the way left in the Los Angeles Times to the New York Post, Newsweek itself, National Review, First Things, The Spectator, American Mind, Fortune, American Compass, Jerusalem Post, Jewish Telegraphic Agency, The Forward, and The Jewish Journal. So he's got all his bases covered. Josh is also highly sought after on the speaker circuit, including a variety of colleges and law schools, where he discusses conservative intellectual trends, contemporary domestic and foreign policy debates, constitutional and legal issues, and the intersection of law, politics, and culture. I, for one, am very happy to think that people on college campuses and in law schools want to speak on those subjects. I'm going to ask him later how enthusiastic the audiences are, because I think it's great. We are going to discuss today one of those slightly esoteric subjects, and that is nationalism, Central Europe and nationalism, a lot of which changed since the invasion of Ukraine. So I would start by saying to Josh and to the audience, the Italian-Israeli author and politician, Fiamma Nierenstein, wrote recently, the EU has built is built on the fear of nationalism and wars as a psychological outcome of its history. Nationalism brought about the First and Second World Wars. German nationalism gave birth to the monster that attempted to conquer all of Europe. Nationalism changed from a component of identity into a brutal and aggressive movement. As a result, Europe constructed itself as a place that is multinational, anti-identity, anti-religious, anti-nationalist, and most important, anti-war. When Europe sees a rifle or a bomb, it gets alarmed. It cannot tolerate this. That was written before the invasion of Ukraine. There's a conversation to be had here on how this affects Europe's relationship with Israel, and we may get to that later. But right now, I'm going to ask Josh to talk to us about nationalism in Hungary, a place he recently visited, and more broadly in Central Europe. Josh Hammer, the floor is yours.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Shoshana. It's been way too long since I've seen you. I know I was supposed to see you in D.C. It didn't work out. Then Florida didn't work out. So hopefully sometime soon. But thank you so much for having me. Big fan of the Jewish Policy Center. So I guess let's start off with the quote right there. The problem when I hear a quote like that, you know, Shoshana read my biography. I'm a research fellow with the Edmund Burke Foundation, which, I, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is it's affiliated with the Israeli scholar Yoram Hazony, who is very much a dear friend and in many ways kind of an intellectual mentor of mine, if I can say that. And you know, when I hear that quote, you know, I can kind of just like envision kind of Yoram just like bristling when he hears that, right? I mean, for those of you who are familiar with his 2018 book, The Virtue of Nationalism, and I would strongly encourage those of you who have not read it to go ahead and pick it up. He actually has a new book coming out as well, but let's stick with the nationalism book, because that's the subject of today's webinar. You know, a lot of this kind of gets into the thorny details, and I'm a lawyer, so I tend to think about semantics and words and definitions. A lot of it kind of boils down to what actually is nationalism, and how does nationalism contrast with transnationalism, internationalism, globalism. I think all these terms are roughly kind of synonymous, or at least very close to synonymous with one another here. So from a certain vantage point, if we can kind of attempt to define what nationalism is, I think it is a certain kind of pride and place in one's kind of customs, folkways, traditions, basic way of life. And that's obviously going to get into kind of one shared culture, one shared language is obviously kind of a strong identity of nationalism, a similar kind of religious heritage. But ideally, obviously, that should obviously be in parallel. The natural corollary of that is kind of a mutual respect from one's own nationalism to other forms of nationalism. So to take kind of, you know, the crass example of all crass examples, and I hesitate to, you know, use the word Hitler 2 minutes into my presentation here, but from that perspective, you know, World War II and the Third Reich was kind of almost the antithesis of nationalism, because they kind of took Aryan supremacy and they viewed it as not necessarily not just consonant with other forms of nationalism. I hold, even holding aside, obviously, Jews in Europe at the time, just Slavic nationalism or things of that nature as well. They viewed it as so fundamentally in contrast with it that it required genocide of other peoples. So I would quibble with the quote that we just heard insofar as World War II was the result of a nationalism that I would readily define as nationalism. It seems to me kind of a murderous and genocidal form of imperialism, kind of a almost the antithesis of nationalism, the antithesis of kind of pride and place in one's home, kind of this subjugationist impulse to kind of go out and kind of conquer the global stage. So, whether it's Napoleon, whether it's Hitler, you know, Alexander the Great, and kind of go back through many of the tyrants or dictators of history who have conquered large swaths of territory. Not all of these are created equal, of course, on various moral grounds, but kind of that impulse to kind of conquer and subjugate foreign peoples whose customs, folkways, language, religion, and so forth might not be necessarily the same as one's own customs and folkways strikes me as fundamentally anti-nationalist, as imperialist, globalist, and so forth. The brutal irony, of course, of the modern day European project, and I guess this will kind of go into Hungary and Poland and some of my recent travels to Central and Eastern Europe. The irony, of course, is that, you know, in the aftermath of World War II, in the aftermath of the Cold War and the dissolution of the Iron Curtain and the end of the Warsaw Pact and all of that, the modern European integration project, the EU in specifically, was, of course, meant to combat that. But instead, I think what we've seen at kind of an empirical level over the past 25, 30 years, and this obviously was kind of the run-up to the tension that led to Brexit in 2016, which obviously caught the entire, you know, political punditry, armchair quarterback world by surprise, was that the EU had become, and I would argue still is to this day, in many ways, still a form of soft imperialism. And it obviously is not the same. I am not drawing a direct moral analogy between the various bureaucrats in Brussels and obviously, you know, the worst genocidal tyrants and dictators of history. But in many way, that urge to kind of conquer and subjugate various kind of nations and peoples and customs and folkways, and to force them to conform to kind of a universalist ideal, a universalist platonic ideal, or even a localist platonic ideal, as the case may be, a European ideal as to what is truly kind of equality, liberty, justice, all these kind of lofty egalitarian Enlightenment-inspired ideals. That is kind of its own form of a soft imperialism. And what's happened, I think, in the dissolution of the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall is so kind of set the table here a little bit more in context. So I've been to both Poland and Hungary within the past year. Last May, I did a trip to Warsaw. I actually got to sit down and interview the prime minister there, Prime Minister Morawiecki, who comes from kind of a conservative political party that we would translate to law and justice here in the United States. And then just about 2 weeks ago, I was over in Hungary and I got to meet their prime minister, Viktor Orban, who is, you know, generally reviled, I guess you would say, by the Western press, who comes from his political party, Fidesz, which is similarly kind of a national conservative party. The Hungarian election is coming up in April, if I'm not mistaken. And I think the polling is looking pretty good for them, but we'll see how that shakes out. So he's been in power now for about 12 years. I think he was elected in 2010. And the common thread here, what you see in kind of that part of Europe, Poland, Hungary, to a lesser extent, maybe Czech Republic and Slovakia, Slovenia, some similar countries around there, they have had a similar history over the past century or so, obviously, where they've kind of been run, they've been overrun by various kind of imperial subjugationist tyrannical forces. The two obvious ones, of course, being Nazi Germany and Stalinist Soviet Union. The Polish people, the Hungarian people, this is Jewish Policy Center. I am obviously proudly Jewish. I don't know if you can see, for those of you watching, I have an IDF flag literally hanging behind my left shoulder. So I was rabbined to fill in about 25 minutes ago. So 3 minutes ago. So my Jewish and Zionist bona fides are not in doubt here. So I would never seek to downplay, obviously, the atrocities that have taken place in that part of Europe, when we can tease that down in the Q&A if we want to. But the unambiguous historical reality is that even kind of holding the uniquely tragic Jewish aspects of that part of European history aside, the even non-Jewish aspects and the non-Jewish history in that part of Europe is very tragic in its own right here. They have been, their cultures were effectively, they tried to eradicate them. I mean, I kind of went down to a more rural part of Hungary actually a couple of weeks ago. And I spoke with a couple of people there. I went to a town. The town was called Pech, P-E-C-E-S, kind of down near the Serbian border in the south of the country there. And there are actually some buildings there that are as far back as when the Ottoman Turks sought to conquer Hungary. So they've had a true history of just various empires that have just sought to kind of subjugate them in their way of life. And in the aftermath of the dissolution of the most recent imperialist project, that of course being Soviet Union, the EU of course being like the true kind of modern imperial project, which is why Fidesz in Hungary and Law and Justice in Poland are so anti-EU. But the upshot here is that in the 20, 25, 30 years since the end of communism in Central and Eastern Europe, these kind of national conservative parties have made it their priorities to kind of elevate their unique cultures, their unique language, and trying to just preserve at effectively all costs their way of life. Hungary has, for example, the Hungarian language is aggressively promoted. They've put in a border wall with Serbia. The Orban himself, he talks very much a language of kind of public Christianity and Hungarian nationalism. They are frequently kind of butting heads with the European Union. The European Union despises what Poland and Hungary have to say when it comes to things like the traditional family unit and LGBT, homosexuality, things of that nature. Poland is one of the most pro-life countries in all of Europe, which I'm sure, you know, triggers all the proper people there in Brussels as well. So from a Jewish perspective, you know, I and this is kind of what I want to go over there and see for myself. I think a lot of people kind of have heard this narrative, whether it's Poland, whether it's Prime Minister Orban in Hungary, and they hear this narrative of kind of, you know, Christian nationalism, strong on borders, dictator, fascist. I mean, all these terms get very loosely floated by kind of the Western press, trying to easily dupe their audiences, I think, when it comes time to talk about some of these countries in Central and Eastern Europe here. But I saw something closely approximating the opposite, honestly, on my most recent trip over there. I actually spent half a day, about 4.5, 5, maybe even 6 hours, I don't remember the exact time. I kind of, by pure happenstance, made a new friend over there who is this Orthodox Jew who was born and raised in Hungary. And he kind of took me on like a local tour of the city. We went to 5, 6, 7 shuls, some gorgeous, gorgeous shuls. Theodor Herzl, of course, was born in Budapest. Went to the shul where he had his bar mitzvah, like just absolutely stunning. I mean, 3,000 to 4,000 seat venue. It's called the Dohany Street Synagogue. If you Google it, I strongly encourage anyone to go if you're ever over in Budapest. we walked around kind of the Jewish ghetto, ate at a wonderful kind of kosher meat restaurant. And I just the general sense that I got there, walking around and talking to various of the locals in particular, the Jewish community there is not in particular trepidation. They are living very openly as Jews, as proud Jews. And there's really not even much in the way of armed security outside a lot of the synagogues that I went to. The big one, the Dohany Street Synagogue, where Herzl's Bar Mitzvah has security because it's just such a towering edifice, kind of in its own right. But you kind of can contrast that with what's happening, obviously, in Western Europe. We've all heard the terrible, terrible stories, obviously, of France and Belgium, obviously Germany itself. I mean, it was It was one or two Yom Kippurs ago where there was kind of that battering ram in Eastern Germany, I think, of this crazy, some sort of Islamic refugee. Look, you talk to the Hungarians on the ground there, and I got into this a little bit with the Poles to a lesser extent when I was there last year. It's for a very, very, very simple reason. And that very simple reason is that Western Europe has taken in all sorts of massive refugees from the Islamic world, and Eastern Europe has not. That really ultimately, at the end of the day, is the foundational difference as far as kind of the quality and the flourishing of Jewish life is concerned. It's not a particularly easy or politically correct thing to say, but it is just unambiguously the truth. I mean, I have observed this with my own eyes there. And the other thing to mention here, when it comes to Prime Minister Orban in particular, you know, I mean, he was Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu's staunchest ally as far as any European leader was concerned at the United Nations. The Hungarian government has consistently voted with Israel as recently as last May's conflict. They, you know, unequivocally sided with Israel over Hamas. Even the Chancellor of Austria at the time, Sebastian Kurz, if you recall, kind of raised the Israeli flag actually in Vienna during that conflict, which was quite symbolic with Austria, of course, being the birthplace of Hitler. But the upshot here is that kind of nationalism is flourishing in this part of Europe in a way that it is fundamentally not flourishing in a Western part of Europe. But we're seeing kind of, I think, the beginnings of a tide shift. Obviously, Zemmour in France, his campaign is attracting a lot of attention for kind of trying to bring back some semblance of French nationalism. The French obviously have gone to extraordinary lengths to try to write out religiosity, to try to write out nationalism, to try to write out any of this from kind of their national ethos. So to even speak of kind of like French nationalism, I think is to be called and, you know, tarred and feathered as a xenophobe and a racist in many ways there in modern day France. But all throughout Europe, you're starting to see the rise, whether it's Zemmour in France, Salvini's party in Italy, Vox in Spain, certainly the Netherlands, Sweden. Almost every European country nowadays has a party that is roughly analogous. The details are always going to differ, of course. That is roughly analogous to kind of Law and Justice in Poland or Fidesz in Hungary, insofar as they realize that the European project has gone a little bit too far in terms of this homogenizing impulse, this imperialist impulse to try to kind of write out local folkways, customs, and ways of life. And obviously, the you cannot underestimate the importance of the migration issue. Having been there, the immigration issue, especially when it pertains to kind of the Islamic world, is such a touchstone in modern day Europe. And various countries feel it different ways here. But I came away from my trip to Budapest fundamentally impressed. As it pertains to Prime Minister Orban himself, I literally stood next to the guy. It's funny how it worked out, actually. I was on my layover in Munich, Germany, and I got like an email from the university that was hosting me. And it was like, oh, by the way, we're meeting with the Prime Minister in 2.5 hours. I was like, what? I mean, I was wearing sweatpants and a hoodie. So I landed in Budapest. I ran to the airport, changed into like remotely decent clothing. And he's just nothing like what the media portrays him as, honestly. This is a guy who briefly studied at Oxford. He actually dedicates one day every week to reading up on substantive political thought. He really tries to dedicate one week to actually reading up, not just on current events, but like actual like political philosophy. I mean, this is a deep guy who has done the reading and knows what he's talking about. And that's not to say that everything is perfect. I would never be an apologist for the Hungarian government or my own government, the American government, by that same measure. But there is a lot going on in that part of Europe that I think is really worth paying attention to. And I guess to a Jewish audience in particular, I would just encourage you, again, to think about what happened over the past century in Europe and all the various tragedies as not necessarily being a problem of nationalism qua nationalism. And I think from a Jewish perspective, certainly from a Zionist perspective, I think it is deeply mistaken to try to write off the idea of nationalism, because there really is kind of there is no more fundamentally inherently nationalist state on the world stage right now than Israel. My good friend Leo Leibovitz wrote a fabulous piece for Tablet magazine a few months ago, talking about how Israel is the most, I think the title of the essay was like the most legitimate nation state on earth or something along those lines there. But anyone who's ever been to Israel, anyone who's ever listened to Hatikva, anyone who's ever kind of seen IDF soldiers kind of walking through the streets of Jerusalem, it is a tremendously nationalist country. And it is truly, I think, kind of nationalism kind of realized in its obviously most anodyne form, but also its true, in its best form, and kind of its platonic ideal form as well. So it's not to say that all forms of nationalism are as beautiful as Israeli nationalism is, but it's to say don't necessarily criticize the idea itself. We can kind of criticize various kind of manifestations of it. But Shoshana, I've probably been ranting here for long enough, I suppose, so we can kind of turn it over to you if you want.
Not ranting at all, actually. I'm finding it really interesting. And we got two questions as you were speaking, having to do with Muslim immigration to Western Europe. As you rightly point out, Central Europeans are not taking Middle Eastern refugees, and European countries are. And so somebody asked, are you blaming the Muslims? But let me ask you something. As Fiamma said, that the Western Europeans are anti-identity, anti-religious, anti-nationalism, and all of that stuff. Is it that Muslim immigrants can't assimilate, don't assimilate, or that Western Europeans don't want them to? They don't feel that it's appropriate to say, come and see. And this, by the way, goes to the other question I just received. Jews as a community do integrate culturally and socially with Western European norms. So not to blame Muslims themselves, is it that Europeans don't ask them to, don't want them to?
So there's, I hear kind of two questions in there. So look, I am not a scholar of Islam. I do not purport to be. But my understanding, of course, is that there is a huge difference between, let's take friend of mine and just a wonderful, wonderful man himself. Let's take like Zudi Jasser, right? The good doctor based out in Arizona, who himself is a faithful Muslim, but goes out of his way to decry political Islam, to decry Sharia supremacy, to decry Islamism, whatever kind of words that are roughly analogous that you want to use to one another there. So it strikes me that, again, I'm not a scholar of Islam, that there is a huge difference between a faithful Muslim who can and readily will assimilate into the fabric of kind of Western society versus an Islamist who, by virtue of what Islamism is, necessarily has kind of a totalitarian global evangelizing impulse to make others kind of subjugate to his or her will. The latter is, I would say, is categorically incompatible with Western democracy, but the former obviously is not, of course. And historically, the American Muslim community has been pretty well integrated historically. I think we're starting to see some kind of balkanization, some fracturing, obviously. There's been any number of kind of, U.S. Department of Justice kind of federal prosecutions for money laundering and terror and whatnot in Minnesota and Minneapolis with the Somali community there. So we're starting to see it fracturing a little bit. I mean, I guess in what ways is America really not fracturing or balkanizing, right? So that's kind of just one of the very many manifestations of kind of a greater unraveling that I personally kind of see here on the home front. But historically, the American Muslim community has been quite well assimilated, and that's by dint of the fact that America traditionally has prioritized assimilation for a very long time. I mean, all of our Jewish ancestors, I think, did obviously the great majority readily, willfully, and happily assimilated into the fabric of American life. So what's happening in modern day Europe, though, again, this is kind of the EU project in particular, it's almost kind of a performative virtue signaling mechanism where I think it's almost kind of the antithesis of assimilation. Because if you assimilation to an extent is kind of the natural corollary of nationalism, right? If you are asking your immigrants to assimilate, well, what are you asking them to assimilate into? Well, the question answers itself, obviously. You're asking them to assimilate into kind of the nation, into the, you know, culture, customs, folkways, language, just the general kind of way of life of that nation. So when you kind of ask for assimilation, it seems to me that you are effectively, implicitly, by very fact of the fact that you're asking for assimilation, you are recognizing the importance, or what Yoram Hazon even called the virtue, of nationalism. But again, what we were talking about earlier, the contrast is that kind of Western Europe, the same parts of Europe that are willfully bringing in all these immigrants, and not just Western Europe, obviously Germany is one of, if not the worst actor in this regard. They don't believe in nationalism here. They believe in kind of the imperialist, kind of homogenizing universalist impulse, the kumbaya, smoke the peace pipe impulse, if you will, if you want to put it in kind of crass or blunt terms, of the modern European project, of modern European integration and the EU. And I think part and parcel of the modern European project is to not necessarily respect nationalism. So therefore, by implication of that, you're also going to reject assimilation and be perfectly comfortable with this notion of kind of balkanized cultures and balkanized places.
So it's interesting. So the one person that you pointed to is Udi Jasser, who I respect enormously, who was an American doing this. And I think you're right. If you don't appreciate your own identity and culture and history and language and all those sorts of things in Western Europe, how can you ask people who come from other cultures to adopt yours? And also, you're right about American Jews in this country. I remember someone saying something about Jews and democracy. When my grandfather got here from Pyzdzhonka, Ukraine, he didn't know anything about democracy. He just had no idea. But it was inculcated into him as an American that these are the things you have to believe in and these are the things you have to worry about. And he ended up, as did my other grandparents, perfectly nationalistic, happy, patriotic Americans. Patriotism, the one word you didn't use in your remarks, and there's a question that goes with this. How do we differentiate between patriotism, which we love to do? I mean, I personally get all teary-eyed on the 4th of July. How do you differentiate between patriotism, nationalism, and imperialism when you cross a line?
So this is a great question. I mean, look, a lot of this does boil down to kind of the lawyerly semantic stuff. So I can attempt to do my best here, right? So look, the late William F. Buckley Jr., of course, kind of the quote-unquote founder of the modern conservative movement, I guess, if you will, towards the end of his life, maybe it was towards the end, at some point, I can't remember exactly when it was, he at some point he said, you know, call me a patriot all you want, but never call me a nationalist. So to him, there actually was a huge distinction there. But with all due respect, I think that he was working off of a definition of nationalism, which is the one that at the beginning of my comments, I attempted to kind of disprove. I think he was working off of kind of a definition of nationalism that was kind of sown into the conscience of an entire generation or two of Americans as being that which necessarily led to the great, terrible wars of Europe, World War I and World War II. So I understand why that is an impulse. And again, I mean, my textbooks, when I was in middle school and high school, I think would attempt to kind of define nationalism in such that way. I mean, we've all heard the story, right? Kind of the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo, kind of exploded European nationalism there. But again, there was an entirely different kind of construct of nationalism, which is what Yoram Hazoni would say is actually the nationalism even of the Hebrew Bible, right? I mean, kind of the ancient Israelites in many ways are kind of they are the OG, to kind of use the term that the kids use these days, that they're kind of like the OG nation. The ancient Hebrew Israelites are kind of the original nation, and kind of in the traditional kind of formulation of what a nation is, a nation will necessarily form from various tribes, and the tribes themselves realize that they have more in common than that which disunites them. They ultimately kind of form a nation with concrete boundaries and a concrete unified legal system there. So look, like you, Shoshana, I mean, I grew up with going to this very hokey kind of local town 4th of July parade every year. I would deck out my bicycle in red, white, and blue, and the high school band would play Yankee Doodle Dandy and all that stuff. So I'm as patriotic as it gets, but I guess to me, from an American context, I don't necessarily view patriotism and nationalism as necessarily being really that different from one another, to be honest with you. The onus in both times is to reject the imperialist impulse, right? So this is kind of my criticism of kind of you know, the modern kind of, you know, liberal internationalism or kind of certain sects of modern neoconservatism. Is my criticism is that they have taken that imperialist impulse in many ways and like hubristically through pure arrogance tried to kind of forcibly export it or impose it onto foreign cultures that are not their own. But I think the nationalist would say that even though we may believe that there are objective universal truths, it is not necessarily our duty to impose them. You know, John Quincy Adams, I think before he was president, but I think when he was Secretary of State, he has this very famous line that I love to quote all the time, where he says, you know, America is the I'm paraphrasing, I don't remember the quote verbatim. He says, America is the well-wisher of all the world when it comes to equality and liberty, but America is the guarantor only of her own people. So I think that's kind of the nationalist impulse in a nutshell.
So this goes to the question then of Israel. We're going to go to, you knew we were going to get to Israel at some point, right? The other half of what Fiamma wrote was that Israel is a country that is always searching for elements of identity, culture, and religion. In Israel, there is a sense of community, a sense of internal solidarity. Also, whether it wants it or not, Israel is a country at war. Europe doesn't understand that. And they see weapons as bad and they see guns are bad and they go like this. But I think as you've described nationalism, does the nationalism of Israel, is that what makes countries like Hungary and like Poland supporters of Israel in international organizations? Hungary has been a great vote for Israel mm-hmm. in the United Nations. That's a solid vote. Poland also. Do they see Israel as an expression of Jewish nationalism? And do they like Israel? I'm not talking here about Jews. I'm talking about the state of Israel. Is Israel a reflection of something that they understand at home that is nationalism?
I think for Hungary, the answer is yes. Again, Orban and Netanyahu were friendly at a very personal level. I think Bibi wants to like a 3-day diplomatic trip to Budapest, which if I understand his kind of diplomatic history properly is like unheard of. I don't think he's like ever spent like 3 days in like, you know, maybe Washington DC obviously, but with it's very rare. I mean, like he and Orban were very, very close to one another, and it's not just because of kind of the, you know, it's not just because they were drinking the same beer or whiskey or whatever. I mean, I think they actually kind of saw in each other kind of a similar political figure, someone who was out there to protect kind of the border safety, sanctity, and security of their different peoples there. So definitely for Hungary. Poland, it's a little more complicated. I think, you know, for a certain amount of time, obviously, after Poland kind of regained its full independence after the end of communism, there was a certain, there was obviously was a lingering, just deep guilt in the Polish conscience that I think played obviously to Israel's benefit when it came time to vote at the United Nations. There's currently a somewhat of a stalemate, if you will. It's like a detente of some sorts between the Polish and Israeli governments. The Poles, from their understanding, don't necessarily like the way that some folks in Israel, Yair Lapid is probably the worst example of this, like to kind of beat the Poles like they're like the worst scum of the earth. And the Poles, not, you know, they're going to kind of like recoil at that, obviously. So they're in somewhat of a different position there. But yes, I mean, to your question, I mean, there is certainly some of that as well. I mean, there's certainly some, I think, of kind of the modern law and justice led National Conservative Party in Warsaw that looks certainly to kind of Likud or maybe to a slightly lesser extent Prime Minister Bennett or factions like that, and sees also a kindred spirit insofar as they're kind of preserving their customs as well. But the Polish situation is just a little more complicated given, I think, the uniquely delicate and oftentimes tragic history there. I think a kind of a visceral level of true kindred spirits, the current situation in Hungary is kind of more directly analogous, I think.
So we had a question here. You mentioned Slavs, and you mentioned actually various minority nationalities and how during World War II, those were intended to be wiped out. Hitler was not multi-anything. He was a genocidist. But somebody asked if you would explain how ethnic Slavs view nationalism in different countries. Are they looking to create a greater Slavic identity across boundaries, or is this a personal identity that you can use as Jews do in Hungary or other places?
So The honest answer is I'm really not qualified to answer this question. I've actually thought about this a lot over the past couple of weeks as this whole war has exploded. I've actually thought a lot about whether there truly is such thing as Ukrainian nationalism that is distinct from Russian nationalism and things of that nature there. I've dabbled in, I've read a couple essays, so I've tried to kind of inform myself the best I can. It seems to me that it's a very lawyerly answer, obviously. It seems to me that it just depends. So for instance, just a few nights ago, I got dinner here with a great Jewish couple, a friend of mine, and her name is Olga. She was born in Minsk, Belarus. Her grandmother actually still lives in Minsk, Belarus. And I was asking her for kind of her thoughts on this, and she kind of largely agrees with kind of the consensus Western narrative that we should support Ukraine and so forth. But we're talking here about the differences between kind of Ukraine versus Belarus in particular. And she was born in Minsk, and her grandmother still lives there. I was asking her whether she speaks Russian or Belarusian, and she didn't hesitate at all. She just said, oh, Russian, as if it was a silly question. And I was like, well, isn't Belarusian like technically the official language of Belarus? And she was like, maybe, but no one speaks it. So it seems to me like, based on certain kind of metrics, like language, like Belarus might not actually be kind of a true nation state in the philosophical sense of one. It obviously is a nation state in kind of the what we would call the legal positivist sense of one, insofar as it literally is a nation with voting rights at the UN and borders and whatever. Ukraine seems to me like a slightly more difficult question, obviously. I mean, Ukrainian obviously is a language that is distinct from Russian. As everyone who has kind of seen any cable news over the past 2 weeks could tell you, apparently at some point we kind of all seem to have agreed to swap out Kiev for Kyiv, or however we're pronouncing it these days. I can't quite keep track, but we did that for kind of, the symbolic purposes of kind of shelving aside kind of the Sovietization, the Russification, if you will, of Ukraine to kind of stand with the Ukrainian language. But look, there obviously are parts of Ukraine that are filled with ethnic Russians and Russian speakers, obviously, whether it was Crimea, whether it's the Donbass. So I think the tension that your question, Shoshana, is getting at here. Oftentimes, the legal positivist map drawing of modern nation states and the United Nations voting sense of the term does not necessarily perfectly conform to what kind of a philosophical nation is. So Hungary is actually a good example of this. So the Hungarian nation, the lowercase n nation, is actually substantially bigger than the modern kind of positivist nation state of Hungary. And what I mean by that is that there are ethnic Hungarians all throughout what they would call kind of the Transcarpathian Basin in parts of Slovakia, Romania, Western Ukraine. Hungary and Ukraine actually have somewhat frosty relations because of the way that the Ukrainian government is effectively trying to excise Hungarian identity from the ethnic Hungarians in Western Ukraine. It's kind of interesting. So our map drawing does not always perfectly correlate to what the actual nation state is. It's necessarily going to be kind of an imprecise science there. But to take like a much simpler example than Belarus or Ukraine necessarily. So I think about Poland. Poland is ethnically Slavic. Poland and Russia have, it seems to me, quite distinct histories. Okay, no one is going to confuse Polish and the Polish language and the Russian language anytime soon. I would get shot on the streets of Warsaw if I said that Poland and Russia are the same nation, right? And probably deservedly so. I mean, that's just like historically ignorant on stilts. So the Polish people go back a very long way and in a very distinct way than Russia. So it just depends, I guess, is the basic answer.
I think it depends is a good answer in this case. And I think you said two important things. Elon Berman, when he was on with us on Tuesday, Elon is a fluent Russian speaker, not a Ukrainian speaker. And years ago, he was in Ukraine and he tried to do some business in Russian. And even then, this was 4 years ago, the Ukrainians said they would prefer that he speak English. They would deal with his English rather than talk to him in Russian. So I think you're right. There is some longer standing and more specific Ukrainianism that even before we got to this war. So yes, and map drawing, Hungary and Romania had to sign a treaty before Hungary could join NATO because there were Hungarians in Romania and Hungary wanted the territory. And NATO said, no, the map is going to be the map and you have to agree to the map. So they did. But so I think you're absolutely right. I think it depends is serious business. Now, the problem with it depends is it depends on who's talking. And Russia wanted to take that difference between the people in Crimea and Donbass as Russian speakers and cut them off from Ukraine, the Ukrainian speakers. So to the extent that it's part of the justification in Putin's own mind for his own war, it's bad news. If it leads to a kind of broader culturalism that says, I can be of Hungarian origin, but I live in Romania, or I can be, you know, then it's not bad, which seems to me the answer to all the questions about Europe today is it can be good news or bad news, depending on how it goes.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, I think you made a really good point there, right? So I really didn't realize until I was there 2 weeks ago the extent to which there were actually ethnic Hungarians spread out through all these various countries. And the current government under Fidesz and Prime Minister Orban does a lot to support those communities. But my first thought when I was kind of talking with people there and hearing about this was this is actually really not that different than kind of diaspora affairs in Jerusalem and what they're doing for the Jewish community spread throughout the world. So, you know, Jewish nationalism, which Zionism by definition is perfectly compatible, of course, with a Jewish diaspora that, you know, kind of lives and flourishes all throughout the world in the United States, as you and I and the audience, as the case may be. So in theory, you know, that's not in theory, that should not be a problem for Moscow and Russian nationalism. In practice, it obviously has proven to be a problem.
See, it depends. It depends on who's doing it. And it depends to some extent on the motivation. I would suspect the Romanian government would look at Hungarian efforts to do something with Hungarian people in Romania, not very fondly, although they have now organized the border, and I'm not looking for an invasion of Romania by Hungary. So, yeah, it depends. Okay, let's go to this sort of thing that's, again, it depends. Western Europe says of Central Europe, if you are a nationalist, you are a fascist. And a fascist means that, you know, you want to control everything and you want to control the government and you want to control all these things. So we actually had an interesting experience in North America that I did not think that we would have, which is, first of all, Canadian truckers. They're Canadian citizens. They wanted something from their government. They organized themselves. And the Canadian government basically said, they cut your bank account if you gave $25 or more to the Canadian truckers. There were all these stories about people who couldn't buy groceries because the government had cut off their bank accounts. Is it possible? And the Canadian government is on its own, as what we would call a sort of left-wing government. Trudeau certainly sees himself as left-wing. We have the same question here about vaccine mandates. And people who talk about going to New York and you couldn't get into a restaurant except in the back by the kitchen with, you know, without your passport. We also have what we would call a liberal government. I don't know about left wing, but certainly left of center. Can you be left of center and repressive at the same time in the modern context? Yes, of course you could. Stalin was, but I'm going to leave him out there for now. Do we have the same worry about Canadians and Americans?
The same worry being, can liberalism be repressive?
A left-wing government that you want to think is the caring and loving and helps everybody, and therefore we need socialized medicine and we need all these good things for people, and letting in immigrants and paying rent, all these things that come of the left, can those also be manifested in ways that are repressive? And I'm not going to say fascist, but repressive on some kind of continuum.
Yeah, I think the answer to that is clearly yes. I mean, we might think of this, you know, if I can kind of go back to, you know, my legal background, I mean, I would think of this as what Aristotle would call the telos, kind of the overarching orientation of liberalism kind of carried out to its logical conclusion. If you kind of think about what modern liberalism is, according to not necessarily as all of its promulgators, as all of its like initial theorists necessarily as they wrote in kind of their 16th, 17th century treatises, but certainly as it kind of played out over the course of centuries, thinking about like the French Revolution as but one example, certainly, of course, in modern America in the aftermath of the World War II over the past 50, 60, 70 years there, we might think of this as kind of a, you know, the maximization of individual autonomy, of kind of a live and let live sentiment. And when you take that to its logical conclusion, it might not necessarily initially sound terrible, but it is ultimately necessarily going to infringe on the more kind of traditionalist and particularist ideologies or ways of life of others there. So, you know, there's any number of manifestations of this, obviously. I mean, we can kind of take like the traditional kind of family unit and LGBT issues as but one prominent example. You know, my first foray into kind of online writing was years ago, I was an itinerant blogger for the old Red State site, back when my friend Eric Erickson was the editor there. And back in 2013, when the Windsor case was leading up to the U.S. Supreme Court, that was kind of the first of the two landmark same-sex marriage cases, Eric had coined this famous line where he said, "You will be made to care." Because even if they kind of talk the rhetoric of live and let live, of like, who cares, like, you know, do whatever you want and in the confines of your home, they are eventually going to force you to care and to force you to comply with their various idiosyncratic conception of what is good and necessary. Think about kind of like the force, the cake shop cases. Jack Phillips, Masterpiece Cake Shop in Denver, Colorado, where I used to live. I used to live 20 minutes from Jack's Cake Shop, actually. He was a Christian man who just wanted to bake cakes, delicious cakes as the case may be. I've actually tasted it. And he just wanted to bake cakes for people in a way that did not necessarily violate the tenets of his faith and his conscience. There is nothing problematic with that, I would submit, whatsoever. But it is kind of this totalitarian impulse of liberalism, I think, taken to its conclusions. And we can talk about whether it's being properly applied or misapplied. You know, it's getting into kind of theory and praxis, a little bit beyond the confines of this particular webinar. But it absolutely seems to me that kind of the liberal impulse necessarily in many instances will lead to kind of a subjugationist or imperialist mentality. And you see that play out in real time in Europe between the seemingly daily fights that the European Union has with, you know, Budapest, Warsaw, and some of the other countries over there. Literally, when I was there 2 weeks ago, the EU issued some high court ruling, and I don't remember the exact fact pattern, but the European Supreme Tribunal, whatever they exactly call their court in Brussels, issued a ruling that was directly at loggerheads with Hungary's kind of national law pertaining to the definition of marriage. It was effectively like an anti-Hungary ruling. And Hungary obviously just subscribes to the definition of marriage that was ubiquitous in Western civilization up until, you know, about 10, 15 years ago or so. So I definitely do think that it can lead, and oftentimes does lead, to terrible places, with the Canadian trucker example being another just very prominent and kind of very visceral example that we've just seen play out.
So I really hadn't thought that we were going to get to Canadian truckers today. So, but we're coming to the end of our program. And as I warned you, I need to get a positive answer from you to a question that I'm going to ask. So I'm going to try to phrase it in a way that you have no choice but to answer it. So we have talked about totalitarians, left wing and right wing. We've talked about patriotism. We've talked about nationalism. We've talked about what countries do, and a little bit, and I'm really happy that we got into this, individualism and how people can maximize their individual preferences. So as you watch all of this, and also the war in Ukraine, where everybody now wants to be a Ukrainian, everybody wants to support the Ukrainians, I do too. Is it possible that what's happening in Ukraine will give a boost to the positive forms of nationalism, war never being a positive form of anything? But what you see among the Ukrainians is a positive nationalism, making people willing to stand up to the Russians and actually willing to die for what? For their country, for their space, for Ukraine. Could that have a positive impact on the rest of the world?
Sure. Yeah, I can absolutely see that being the case here. So the way that Russia is acting, the way that Putin is acting, strikes me as fundamentally imperialist. I mean, to kind of go back to that nationalism versus imperialism dichotomy, he is acting in a manner that is the precise opposite of nationalism. It is the precise opposite of anything remotely resembling a respect for other cultures, other languages, even cultures and languages that are, as the case may be, quite similar. But, you know, by the same token, the U.S. is not marching into Canada because we're nationalists here. We're not imperialists. I've seen some conservatives kind of joke on Twitter about, like, annex Alberta and Saskatchewan, kind of the conservative parts in Canada. I don't know how much they're all joking, but it's not a serious political talking point in any event here. So Putin is acting in a way that is fundamentally imperialist, that is not nationalist. And, you know, it was Rich Lowry of National Review who, if I saw, he wrote his syndicated column this week praising Ukrainian nationalism. And I even saw, I think, Jonah Goldberg, who has gone above and beyond to distance himself from nationalism. I even saw him praise Rich Lowry's column as basically saying that if nationalism has anything going for it, this is it. I mean, this is kind of a great manifestation of it. So I absolutely could see this being a positive example for, you know, other parts of the world, other countries, other peoples that might see themselves invaded by would be or, you know, effective kind of imperialist powers. The elephant in the room, of course, when we're talking about this is obviously the Taiwan-China standoff. That's the real elephant in the room here. I don't have a great prediction as to what's going to happen on that front. But at a bare minimum, I hope and I would expect that the Taiwanese people, excuse me, their spirits were hopefully lifted by just the courage that we've seen on display, obviously, by Zelensky and the Ukrainian people, and really kind of just refusing to bend the knee to a revanchist imperialist power. So I definitely do find cause for optimism from this example, Shoshana, for sure.
I can tell you for sure that the Taiwanese admire the Ukrainians. I have talked to the Taiwanese, but what the Taiwanese feel is that China may be emboldened. If we don't get the Russia part of this right, if we don't get the punishment part of this right, the Chinese will feel empowered to go and grab Taiwan. They will have as much trouble in Taiwan as the Russians are having in Ukraine, but that's their fear. And yes, they are happy to see people in another country who are willing to stand up for their country. And that's a positive note. So that's where we're going to end. And I'm going to say, Josh, thank you for being with us. It was enlightening. It's always a good idea to think about the basis of your own political beliefs. And I think what you brought to us today is the idea that you have to think about nationalism, imperialism, fascism, patriotism. You've got to go there because the world is an evolving place. Let us hope that it evolves peacefully and happily. So thank you for your contribution to our thought process. To everybody out there, thank you for listening. We will be back again next week. And I promise, but it depends. That we will be back next Thursday with a program. I don't expect emergency programming like we had this week, but it depends. You never know. So thank you for joining us, and we'll see you again.
Thanks so much, Shoshana.